Hello and welcome to the IEA podcast. The episode you're about to listen to was originally featured as a video on the IEA London YouTube channel, but we've taken the audio and turned it into a podcast so that you can listen on the go. Enjoy.
I'm Lynn Shackleton, Editorial and Research Fellow at the Institute of Economic Affairs, and today I'm joined by Scottish comedian and writer Leo Kirse. He describes himself as one of the UK's few openly right-wing comedians. Now, Leo has written a chapter for the IEA's new book on free speech, Having Your Say, Threats to Free Speech in the 21st Century. He's written about freedom of speech in comedy. And in his chapter, Leo examines the history of censorship in comedy, his own personal experience of being banned from a fringe festival, and his experience performing secret underground comedy shows in autocratic regimes. So it's going to be an interesting discussion, I think. Welcome, Leo, to the channel. How are you?
Hello, Lynn.
I'll start off by saying, you know, what's the past year been like for you as a comedian? You're a stand-up, right? And you've had to sit down in front of Zoom screens for, for months on end. How have you managed in the last 15 months?
Yeah, I mean, coronavirus pandemics aren't great for comedy. Our whole business model is based around getting people packed in as closely as possible into very low ceiling basements. And then they're all laughing. So we're all spreading particles of virus to each other. So it's kind of the last thing that's allowed under a lockdown. So there were other sort of gigs going on. There are gigs to people in cars, where you're like, people are sitting in their cars and you're on stage shouting at them and people beep the horn instead of laughing. Now that we've sort of, you know, we've eased lockdown restrictions, some of the clubs have opened with social distancing. So your people aren't as packed in, it's maybe half capacity. And some club like Top Secret, like one of the best clubs in the country, it's got like Perspex sheets between the rows. So then if you're sitting at the back, you're looking through about six sheets of Perspex. it's very strange. You sort of feel like you're in some sort of trial for people who've committed terrible crimes and have to be kept in a glass cage. You know, they cut someone's skin off and ate it or something, or some sort of pet shop for very rich people who can afford actual humans. But it works. I was actually stuck in Australia for the first part of the lockdown, which was great, and I wish I'd stayed there. And the day after I left, they reopened, and I came back to the UK thinking, well, we're over the first wave, so that's it. And then no, it just kept on going, and now, you know, I'm unsure if we're ever gonna like come out of lockdown properly.
Well, let's hope we are. I keep my fingers crossed for July the 19th. I said at the beginning, you know, you style yourself as a right-wing comedian. What exactly does that mean? That's not dropping people out of helicopters or anything like that, is it? I mean, it's a libertarian right-wing you're coming from. What are what is your political position, Leo?
I think people have got the wrong idea about what right-wing means. I mean, a lot of other comedians have described me, I was described as, when I ran for Parliament in Scotland, somebody described me as a far-right demagogue. I've been called a fascist and all the rest of it, and I'm just being honest. I just don't like paying tax, and I don't like the government being involved in my life. I think I can, you know, I know what I want to spend my money on, and I also know what I want to do and who I want to associate with and where I want to go, and I don't need the government to come in and get involved in my life and tell me, no, you can't do that, you can't do that, no, we're going to take this money off you and we're going to spend it on this. And I think if we're being honest, that's what most people feel. Nobody looks forward to filling in their tax return and seeing that big chunk of money going to the government. I understand there's some stuff that's essential, you know, like it's great that I'm in favour of socialised healthcare. I think the NHS is great, although, you know, it's kind of annoying how you've got to be so grateful. And I'm in favour of having roads. You know, we can't all have private roads, but a lot of stuff, we don't need diversity coordinators in every council. Like, there's a lot of money. I used to work in the public sector. There's so much money wasted. So I think comedians are being disingenuous. Other comedians are being disingenuous when they accuse me of being, you know, some sort of fascist or whatever, because they all take the money from the cash gigs and stick it under the mattress. You know, every comedian is a self-starting Thatcherite entrepreneur going out and hustling for work in a free market. So really, you know, for them to all claim that they're socialists is ridiculous. If they were socialists, they'd all work for the council and just turn up, clock in and then sit on their bums doing nothing. That's socialism.
So it's a kind of false consciousness, you think, that they don't understand what they're really on about, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, words like, you know, fascist, far-right, racist, they've lost all meaning. Like, all meaning. Like, if Hitler came back today and, you know, saw me, he wouldn't be like, you know, wow, what an impressive Nazi. You know what I mean? He'd be very disappointed at the state of modern Nazis. We seem a lot like what left-wing people were in the 1990s. And a lot of my friends, I was talking to my friend Nico about this, so he's a comedian as well, and he feels like a sort of, you know, tolerant liberal person, and he started off fairly left-wing in the 90s, and then the whole world has just gone crazy, you know, and we're sort of left on this rock.
I mean, that's an interesting thing. I mean, you touched on this in your writing and in your act. You know, we have this period of, you know, I'm older than you. We have this period of cultural liberalisation in the 60s and 70s when virtually anything went. Yeah. But since then, we've had this kind of drift back towards, you know, we've got governments, we've got politicians, we've got pressure groups of all kinds, you know, attacking what we think of as freedom of speech. But there is another argument, isn't there, saying, well, the reason we're doing this is that we're all much nicer people now. We're sensitive, we're caring, and all that kind of stuff. What do you think about that line, Leo? I mean,
well, it's interesting that you mention all the institutions and government and, you know, the politicians withdrawing freedom of speech, because I see it more as a sort of cultural movement, and it's almost a religious. I mean, I think in the past, you know, if you went back to the 1940s, a lot of the sort of restrictions on freedom of speech came from like Mary Whitehouse was religious. She was a yeah. you know, devout Christian, and now it's devout wokist. There's, you know, the religion has left our lives, and wokeism has come in to replace it. And it's got all the hallmarks of religion. It's got these tenets that you have to slavishly follow, and if anybody, you know, steps slightly, you know, has slightly the wrong opinion, you know, gets one of the commandments wrong, then they're thrown out from the herd and chastised. It's got everything the religion has except for forgiveness, and also it doesn't have fixed tenets. It's very difficult to, like, you know, stay on top. You've got to read The Guardian every single day to see, you know, even the terminology, like, you know, people of color. Well, then, you know, then you've got to use BAME, then you've got to use BIPOC. And if you use the wrong term, if you use an old term, like in the 70s, coloured was the appropriate term to use. That was the woke term. And obviously, if you use that now, you lost your BBC presenting job forever. So really, I see wokeism as taking our freedom of speech away. And it's really growing in strength, and it's through all our institutions, and particularly places like HR departments. So now their advice, I mean, you get government policy that comes through, like hate crime laws that are woke, but they're scrutinized by parliament, so they're held up to a certain standard. The more worrying thing for me is things like HR department guidance that says, you know, you can fire someone because of their facial expression, because that could be a racist microaggression, or the guidance that goes from the College of Policing that says if somebody's accused of a hate crime, you record it as a non-crime hate incident. And these, you know, a non-crime hate incident can show up in a DBS check, so it can prevent somebody from getting a job, even though they've not committed a crime, they've not come anywhere near, you know, the threshold of criminality. So it's these sort of systemically woke tendrils that have gone through society and all our institutions that really worry me when it comes to freedom of speech.
I mean, one of the things you sound off about on some of your gigs are like the Oxbridge kind of comedians and their dominance of the BBC. I mean, a lot of the comedy which most people see is actually from the BBC, isn't it? I mean, do you think that the BBC You know, what's your attitude there? Should we scrap the BBC? What should we sell it off? What should we do with it?
I think it definitely needs to be restructured. I think the BBC does some things amazingly well. So BBC World Service is incredible. Like, it's my favourite radio station. The news coverage is, you know, it's slightly biased, but I think it's very good. And their nature and documentary programme, their factual programming is amazing. Their entertainment programming, why are we paying the state to produce our entertainment? It's ridiculous. It's, you know, the BBC, people don't seem to understand, the BBC is the sort of state propaganda wing. So, that would suggest that you shouldn't have it producing news or anything as well, but I do think it's, you know, they hold the news to a pretty good standard. But the entertainment, like the comedy on the BBC is ridiculous. At the moment, it's so driven by woke trends. You see people, I mean, there's so much talent on the comedy circuit. And in the 90s, comedy commissioners used to go down to the comedy clubs and see who was funny and then, you know, give them a shot. And now they're not doing that. Now they're looking, they're like, oh, we need somebody who's diverse, by which they mean anything that's not a straight white man. Because most comedians are straight white men, because most people are straight. In the UK, most people are white. And it's mostly men who want to do comedy. So, you know, you're going to get a lot of straight white men in comedy. Now they're like, okay, we need somebody diverse. And they're not looking to see, you know, what's the person saying? What's their diversity of thought and opinion? And how funny are they? They're not looking at that. They're looking at just their sort of immutable characteristics.
Do you think this is a particularly British problem? I mean, you've traveled the world a bit and you've performed in different countries. Do you think we are, you know, if we had a wokeometer, how high up would we be in the, you know, we'd be very, very woke, or would be, you know, quite reasonable compared with some other countries you've been in?
Well, yeah, it's funny. I mean, because I consider the UK, particularly Scotland, by the way, to be, you know, very, very woke. The government in Scotland is intolerably woke, and the society in the UK is intolerably woke. But then I've got friends from America, like Andy Ngo, for example. So he's a journalist who investigated Antifa. And he's moving to the UK as a political refugee. He considers himself, you know, almost, you know, a political refugee. You know, when he's in Portland or whatever, when he's investigating Antifa there, he gets attacked, he gets put in hospital and stuff. And his parents, like, left Vietnam. I'm pretty sure it's Vietnam. Went to America as political refugees, and now he's coming to the UK as a, you know, to a certain extent, a political refugee. So I'm like, it's so bad. How bad is it in America? If here is better, you know?
It's strange, ironic echo, isn't it, Leo, of the sort of anti-communist thing in the 50s when Americans would come over here to get away from all that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And funnily enough, people from the former Soviet Union, people from Mao's China, like, I've warned, you know, and said, like, look, what you're doing with all this, like, woke stuff, I mean, that's probably not the words they use, but what you're doing with all this woke stuff is, you know, it's on a slippery slope to authoritarianism and, you know, destroying people's lives.
Can I just talk? I mean, you talk in your chapter that, you know, this excellent chapter, which I do, you know, recommend to all our viewers to have a look at. You know, you do talk about the way in which you were banned in Perth. Now, this is Perth, Australia, isn't it? It's not Perth in Scotland. Talk us through that. What happened there, and what was the sort of outcome of it in the sort of medium term?
So in 2019, I was over in Perth, Australia, to perform at the comedy festival. And I had this show called Right Wing Comedian. And people saw that, you know, because I'm in a very, very woke industry. If I was in, you know, working on building sites or whatever, wokeism probably wouldn't be so much of a problem. But working in the arts, oh my God, they're all for tolerance and diversity, but not for tolerance and diversity of different opinions, you know. So, you know, people saw that I was doing the show Right Wing Comedian, and it was like a red flag to a bull. And so they tried to get me cancelled. So they went through my Twitter account. And normally they do this they did it to Kevin Hart. They went back like 7 years and found something that he tweeted and got him cancelled. With me, they went back to that afternoon. It was literally the most recent thing I tweeted, and it was a clip from a show where I was talking about the difference between males transitioning to women and females transitioning to men, and how much, you know, harder it is for men to transition, because obviously, you know, you get like small feminine men, so women can pass as a man, but you don't get so many sort of 6'4" women with, you know, hands like shovels and, you know, prominent brow bones and jaw bones. So it's hard. So I have this bit of material. And so people got me cancelled because of this material. They said, you know, this man's being transphobic. He's talking about people transitioning. And what they didn't know, and I was immediately cancelled. The venue just immediately cancelled my show. I had to find another venue, spend $3,500, you know, sorting out another venue. What they didn't give me the right to reply was I wrote the offending material with a transgender woman that was dating. So it was giving a voice to, you know, rare marginalized transgender voices in a way. Not even in a way, it just definitely was. And so by canceling me, they canceled her voice. So, you know, these woke people who, you know, consider themselves to be uplifting, you know, diverse and marginalized voices, were actually, you know, smashing them into the ground. And also then I had the wrong sort of, you know, there was a controversy, and it boosted ticket sales a bit. But then I had some of the wrong sort of people coming to the show, because it's not a it's not a hate fest. I'm not transphobic in the show. I'm talking about, you know, about dating a transgender woman, but in, you know, nice inclusive terms. And I think a lot of the people who got me cancelled, if they actually came to the show and saw it, they might actually enjoy it, and they might open their mind a bit about, you know, what it's like dating a transgender woman and what it's like being right wing.
That's a very interesting angle on it, Leah. Tell me, you also write in this chapter about self-censorship, and you write about it in quite a kind of positive way, at least the way I read it, that, you know, you think it's something we have to do, we all have to do, but you need to be able to, censor according to the room, according to the kind of audience you're facing, and so on. Mm. I mean, that is an interesting kind of angle on it. Do you think you're self-censoring more than you were in the past? Because I mean, I must say, having looked at some of your gigs, I can't see much sign of self-censorship. But you are doing it. What would it be like if you really let go? That's what I want to
think. Yeah, maybe it's just as well we're living under this, you know, blanket. But yeah, I mean, comedians are constantly self-censoring, because we've got to judge what's working, what isn't working, not just in terms of material, but you know, you can see if people, you can see what the previous comedians have done, you know, what the audience are going for. You look at the audience, you look at the age of them and all the rest of it, and you can sort of, you know, work out, you know, if I'm doing a kids show, I'm not going to be talking about, you know, dating a transgender woman. Although if I was doing a kids show, I'd probably get a government grant to talk about dating a transgender woman. But so we're always self-censoring. This is why censorship in comedy is completely unnecessary. I mean, when I go out and do a show, I'm performing to, you know, a cross-section of society. They're like a jury that have been picked from society, and they're constantly judging. If I say anything that's genuinely horrible and, you know, genuinely nasty and bigoted and offensive, they're not going to laugh, because that would be horrible. So people will only laugh at, you know, something they can see the warmth and, you know, compassion. And they can only laugh at, you know, some can only really be funny if it's not horrible.
Right. I want to come on now to, you know, you mentioned briefly earlier on how you stood in the recent Scottish parliamentary elections. Yeah. And for those of viewers who aren't aware of this, Leo stood for the Reclaim Party in Glasgow, wasn't it, somewhere? Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Now, tell us about that experience. That must have been a funny thing.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've been friends with Lawrence Fox for a while, and, you know, really sort of identified with what happened to him. So he, you know, he was cancelled from, he was making so much money as an actor. He had this amazing career, and, you know, he's got kids and all the rest of it, and then the woke mob just turned on him. Not because he hadn't skinned anyone alive or anything, he hadn't kicked a cat over a car. He just, you know, expressed some fairly reasonable opinions that I think a lot of people would agree with, and I think should be allowed to be expressed. I don't, you know, necessarily agree with all of them, but like, whatever. That's the whole thing with opinions. We don't all have the same ones. And he was cancelled from his acting career. And, you know, he's a father. How's he going to, like, support his kids and, you know, and also, you know, your whole social life and, you know, your whole, a lot, as men, a lot of our worth as a person is attached to what we do. So I thought it was disgusting what happened to him and really unfair. So, you know, I got in touch and, you know, I ended up running for Reclaiming Glasgow against Humza Yousaf, who's Justice Minister. Justice. Well, he's moved on to health now. So he's the architect of the hate crime bill in Scotland, which is a really pernicious piece of woke legislation that basically it criminalizes anything that, you know, you perceive to be a hate crime can be reported as a hate crime. And, you know, even if you're investigated and found to be innocent, it gets recorded as a non-crime hate incident. Then HR departments, if they do a DBS check, that will show up. So it can really destroy your life. And it's, you know, it's only used, the only people that I know that have used it are angry ex-girlfriends. I'm not even joking. It's, you know, it's just so open to malicious abuse. And also it criminalizes speech in the home. So, and we've all got listening devices in our homes. I've got my phone here, my laptop. You know, I don't have Alexa because I'm in a hotel. But we're creating these laws that could really usher through a horrible Orwellian nightmare. So, you know, I think it's important to make a stand against it. And the SNP have, you know, a pretty terrible record on freedom of speech, and particularly freedom of speech in comedy. The SNP own the main comedy clubs in Scotland. It's mad. So the stand comedy clubs are owned by an SNP politician. So no comedians in Scotland can criticise the SNP because they'll destroy their comedy career in Scotland. So, you know, I don't think I'll ever be asked to play at the stand again. And, you know, that's very sort of, you know, Maoist to actually, you know, have the government control the last bastions of free speech. I'm really, like, I seem to be the only person who finds it, you know, at all worrying.
I mean, what is your take on Scotland these days? I mean, you're the kind of person they don't like, aren't you? You're a cosmopolitan Scot. You spend a lot of time outside the country. You won't have a vote if it goes to another referendum, will you? I mean, you're the sort of nasty person who's not really Scottish. Yeah, I mean, do you feel that you're discriminated against by the SNP and the whole Scottish culture, if you like?
Yeah, I mean, I've moved back down to London because, I couldn't make a living as a comedian in Scotland. There are clubs that book me. There's some fantastic comedy clubs in Scotland as well. I don't know, I feel more at home in England. The SNP have really fomented this sort of parochial attitude in Scotland. And because the SNP have used this sort of cloak of wokeness to sort of trick everybody into thinking that they're nice, cuddly, warm socialists who just want to, you know, I mean, they're being socialists with somebody else's money. They get £14 billion a year extra from England through the Barnett formula, from the rest of the UK through the Barnett formula. It's easy to be a socialist with someone else's money. But you know, they use all this wokeness to say, you know, oh, we're diverse, we're tolerant and all the rest of it. But they're just using it to sort of cover up their own hyper-nationalism. So the level of xenophobia in Scotland, I was really shocked when I moved back up there last year. There's so much open anti-English. I mean, it gets disguised. They say, like, you know, Tory scum out and stuff like that. But they mean English. You know, they're not just talking about Tories. And you know, we had people at the border in hazmat suits yelling at English cars to f off back to England. You know, terrible stuff. If that was happening, if that was Tory voters doing it at Dover to, you know, ferries that were coming over, there would be uproar. But because Scottish nationalism isn't seen as, you know, this evil nationalism the same as English nationalism is. I think English nationalism, everybody's aware of the dangers of it. Everybody knows, you know, how toxic it is. Scottish nationalism is even more toxic because people think it's good, because Scottish nationalists are pushing back against England. And England, of course, is seen as this colonialist aggressor. It's the straight white man of countries. So anything you say to England is fine. So yeah, I was really shocked what's happened to Scotland. And they're using, you know, the hate crime laws. They're not using that to try and make you know, transgender people feel more included or anything. Sturgeon used it to get rid of Joanna Cherry. Joanna Cherry was her rival in the front bench of the SNP, and she was accused of being transphobic. She's not, she's a feminist. But she was accused of being transphobic as a sort of means to, you know, purge her from the front bench and send her to the gulags, the back bench.
Now, you know, what was it actually like standing as a political candidate? I mean, did you have sort of public meetings you didn't do very well, did you? I mean, to be honest, I mean, you got about 100 votes, was it? Something like that?
I
mean,
I got 114 votes, and I got like a few hundred more in the region.
All right, the regional vote, yeah.
But I mean, we weren't running to win. It would have been nice
in a kind of dream world where you did win. What would you actually do? What do you think if you were an MSP?
I mean, just staying on actually running for election. We had our big, like, I got cancelled from I was cancelled from an independent hustings. So the government actually stepped in to cancel me from opportunities to speak, which, you know, I'm not sure, you know, the independent hustings, that was cleared by the police. So I'm not sure why the government stepped in to stop political speakers at it. They allowed, you know, scientists and doctors to speak at it, but not politicians. And, you know, it was specifically me and Michelle Ballantyne who were the politicians who were going to speak at it. So every opportunity to, you know, to get the message out there seemed to be stifled by the Scottish government. And even, so we had over 300,000 leaflets printed, and they're due to be distributed. Basically, when you sign up to run as a candidate, the Royal Mail deliver, it's called the election address, they deliver a leaflet to every house. With these printers, I was told don't use a Scottish printer because, you know, business in Scotland is so dependent on getting public service, public sector work, because the public sector is such a huge part of the economy in Scotland, that nobody will want to do something that's seen as going against the government. So, you know, but the party thought it was important to use a Scottish printer because you can't have some printed in Essex and then distributed in Scotland. George Galloway used printers in Essex. So he knew what was going on. We used Scottish printers, and somehow these 300,000 leaflets never made it to the Royal Mail and never made it out to people's houses. So I was supposed to have one in every household in Glasgow, and it was a brilliant leaflet, really, you know, brilliantly produced and really laid out, you know, what I was standing for. It was so much better than the other leaflets I saw, and it was stifled. So, I mean, I wouldn't have won if that had gone out, but it would have at least, you know, awoken people to the dangers of the hate crime bill, which is all I really wanted to do. So I really feel that the Scottish government, you know, I mean, obviously I can't make accusations or anything because, you know, I don't have evidence, but it seems that, you know, every step my voice was just being squashed.
The question I asked you before was you know, what would you do if you were an MSP? What kind of things would you look to prioritize? You've spoken about hate crime, for example, but what other issues? Corruption, you know, what's your take?
I mean, if I was in Holyrood, if I was in the Scottish Parliament as an independent candidate, I would scrutinize everything that the government did, every piece of legislation it passed, and also, because I think we have too much legislation, government's passed way too much, we don't need all this legislation. And also, we don't need the government to be at the size it is. Like, I think a smaller government is just so much better for society. We need a stronger private sector, and the government should be there to sort of more regulate the private sector and make sure that they're not doing anything bad, like dumping, you know, toxic waste in a canal or anything like that. We should be there to regulate the private sector rather than to take over and, you know, create our own economy. We shouldn't be providing services that can be provided by the private sector. But also, if I got in, I'd just enjoy being on the public sector government gravy train. I think it'd be nice to kick back for 4 years. I mean, I spoke to George Galloway about it. He originally asked me to run for his party, Alliance for Unity. I said, you know, but George, I'm a comedian, you know, I'm worried that, you know, if I get in, I'm going to have, you know, this heavy workload. And he was like, no, don't worry about it. The only time you work is when you're trying to get in. After that, you can chill out.
He's an interesting character, George, isn't he? Yeah.
You know, but I like that attitude.
Okay, well, thanks, Leo. I mean, this has been great talking to you. We've got to wind up now, I'm afraid. Thanks a lot for this. And thank viewers, thank you for watching. If you'd like to directly support the IEA's digital output, you can sign up to become an IEA patron. You'll get early access to our videos, bespoke perks of various kinds from the IEA, other benefits and so on. So head over to patreon.com/IEA London, or one word, or follow the link in the description box to find out.
Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to the IEA podcast wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify or Podbean. And as you've been listening to an audio recording from a YouTube video, you can visit the IEA London YouTube channel and subscribe there as well.